Session number 16630, Marguerite Patton, Reel 3.
Patton, Reel 3. Oranges came into the country very, very rarely. But when they did come in, they were reserved for children's ration books. And each child would have a pound. The peel wasn't wasted. Mothers used to save that, or most mothers, and make orange peel marmalade. It's very good, as a matter of fact. I've had to make it up a number of times to tell people about it. And you married up the orange peel with a fruit we could get throughout the winter, and that was good old British cooking apples. So that really was the general picture of rationing. What about the unrationed foods? What have we got? Well, we had root vegetables, and farmers, of course, were digging feverishly. Dig for Victory was one of the great big campaigns. And so often people used to dig up their fruit, their flower gardens, and put vegetables there. My mother had a long garden. I was living with her at that time, of course. And in the evening, Mother and I, fortunately, we're both very keen gardeners, used to go out in the garden, and we grew our own onions and potatoes and vegetables. So that helped out enormously, particularly in summertime. We also grew a lot of fruit. And that, of course, was another thing that happened so much during those years of scarcity. We bottled everything that could go into a bottle. And so in summertime, you put fruit into bottling jars, sterilize them, ready for the winter. That took up a lot of time, showing people how to do that in summer. Because for many town people, they'd never bottled before. They could get canned fruit and things like that. Why bother? Why indeed? But they just had to do that. Because canned fruit was obtainable, but very, very little. How did you get that? Was that on the ration? Yes and no. It wasn't on the official rations, but it was on the point system. And the point system is quite difficult for people to understand today. We had 16 points a month. And you had to make terrible decisions about those 16 points. You see, you don't make decisions about the rations. You knew what they were. You collected them and you knew you'd get them. But the point system, would you buy a can of fruit or a can of salmon or corned beef? Or would you buy 3 pounds of split peas, which would last a very long time? Or would you buy some dried fruit? So you had to make this terrible decision as to how you would spend those points. That's the only way we would get canned fruit. Of course, servicemen coming back possibly could bring some with them. But I'm going to strike a personal note here about my brother. I said earlier that he was married early in 1943. He lost his ship at Alexandra. It was bombed twice. Fortunately, he wasn't killed, but the ship was virtually destroyed after the second bombing. Now, my brother is a very persistent person, and he had collected, he'd come from, I believe, Australia at the time, so he'd gathered up some splendid tins of fruit towards the wedding reception, and Philip wasn't going to be cheated of his tins of fruit. So I believe he trekked across somewhere, Greece or somewhere, with an enormous sack of fruit and things like that, and lost most of his other possessions, but he came home just before the wedding with all those precious tins of fruit. So he really became a hero to have done that. That's a little sidetrack. What sort of things did one demonstrate at Harrods? Just the same as my colleagues in the Ministry of Food were demonstrating all over in Britain. Interesting recipes, because we were very anxious that people should enjoy their food. So you used to say, I've got a lovely recipe for a pudding. And it was only at the end you'd probably say, by the way, did you notice it only took 1 ounce of fat and it didn't have any eggs in it? Our attitude to teaching, I suppose that is the word, or helping the public, was rather different from the attitude of today. Now, today, the authority tends to wag fingers and say, you must cut down on that, you shouldn't do that. Can't remember ever saying those words in wartime. We did the other way around. Here is a recipe that you will enjoy. Here is a splendid way to eke out the meat. It's a lovely dish. We extolled the virtues of what we were doing rather than being gloomy. I think the thing was there was enough gloom about. And really, it was our job to make life as cheerful as possible. That was all part of it. I do remember in Harrods, at a period, the news was very bad. I can't remember exactly what had happened. I also remember there'd been one or two minor cuts in the ration, which always filled people with gloom. And one of the directors came down in Harrods and said to me, Marguerite, make them laugh. And so I had all my audience in turn tossing eggless pancakes in the air. I mean, that's flippant and stupid, but it was all part of trying to cheer us up. Remember my mother and I laughing until the tears came into our eyes at wonderful comedians like Tommy Handley, who you've not heard of today, Itmar. That was one of the wonderful things. There was a character in that who used to say, it's being so cheerful that keeps me going. I mean, you wouldn't laugh today at it, I'm sure. But we really laughed very easily. The films that came out were lovely musicals, full of colour, full of gaiety. Anything that made us forget for a short time that we really were very worried. We were worried, but by Jove, we were tough. And this I've said time and time again. When people have asked me over the last 10 years, do you think the wartime rations were better than today? And I have to say, really, what nonsense. Do we really want to go back? I mean, you've even had some rather grand people saying, go back to wartime rations. And I look at them and I think, yes, you don't remember them. You don't remember the queuing to get those. You don't remember how you long to have a slice of lemon on a piece of rather tired fish. You don't remember longing for a grapefruit for breakfast. We can't go back, but we can take some of the lessons of those wartime years, was to use good, fresh food. And it was fresh. You see, it wasn't imported. It was grown here, so it was fresh. But I also think the other thing that kept us healthy, and I feel this very, very strongly, is the spirit that was about then. I remember having gastric flu. I also had my appendix out during those years. And Harrods had a doctor and a nurse as well. And when I came back, they didn't say, aren't you splendid to come back so quickly? They just said, right, yes, you're good, you're back, you didn't linger. And they would have been horrified had I lingered. Now, I wasn't a soldier or somebody really whose work was essential, but I felt like we all felt I must do my job to the very best of my ability. We were fighting a war. People have mocked my comments about this since, and I just keep saying it. We were fighting a war, all of us, on the kitchen front, everywhere, and it was a war we had to win. Several times people have said to me, didn't you find it derogatory that you were part of the kitchen front? I look at them in amazement. I say, what do you mean, derogatory? You had the Europe front, you had fronts everywhere. We were the home front, and the kitchen front was part of the home front. My goodness, if we hadn't done our bit, we would have let Britain down.
Did you find people were generally receptive to the ideas you were promoting, you know, about fresh vegetables and the cooking time and the recipes?
During the war, yes. When war ended and rationing went on and on until 1954, finally ended, they grumbled more. We all did, I think. You know, we weren't stupid enough to expect rationing to end the moment the war ended. But we really didn't think it would go on for all those years. And towards the end of the 1940s, or 46, 47, it got worse. Meat ration was lowered slightly. There was bread rationing. And I think we all felt, well, this is a bit much. I mean, I know I felt it too, and I had to pretend, you know, everything was lovely. But it did go on a very long time. You want to remember, we were very tired as well. We were tired of rationing. And it wasn't just food that was rationing. Rationed soap was rationed, clothes were rationed, clothes were short. We had a burglary, my mother and I, and our handbags were stolen. We got the handbags were left. It was somebody during an air raid who got in. You see, we were careless, and took our ration books. And our clothes ration books as well. And I know in order to get the clothes ration back, you had to detail how many shoes you got, how many sheets you got. It really was a nightmare. So all those things had been going on and on. I believe clothes rationing ended towards the end of the 1940s. I'm not quite sure about that because it wasn't my sort of department. I wasn't in that industry. I can't remember when soap rationing ended, but if somebody gave you a bar of soap as a present, you know, it was marvellous. I don't know if it looked as if you were dirty, but you didn't accept it as that, you accepted it as generosity. The other thing, using the word generosity, that I would love to be able to paint a picture of is people's behaviour to each other. Now, I can describe the rations during the war. I can fill books, I have done, with wartime dishes. But what I can't really capture for people is how everybody behaved to one another. I always say that if there had been a wedding in the road, I'm pretty certain that somebody would have knocked at your door and said, I hear your daughter's getting married or your son's getting married. I'm lucky. I don't drink much tea. I've got a quarter pound of tea. Would that help? Or I've got some soap, would you give it to her as my little present? Or is there anything I can do? And that was the spirit. I know it sounds far-fetched, but it was the spirit around. We were all together. I think there were a number of examples of that I can quote. I've quoted them quite often, so they're quite well known, these stories. There was one enchanting lady who came to my demonstration. It's always rumoured she was slightly related to the royal family. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. But the important thing was that she never cooked in her life before, like a lot of Heron's customers hadn't. They'd had a cook, they'd had a maid, they'd had a chauffeur. And they'd been very lucky to have that. And suddenly they'd all gone. And they had to buckle to and get on with it. And often they weren't that young, so it was a time of life when really it was very difficult. So they had to absorb rationing, absorb cooking, absorb housework and all those other things as well. And they were so grateful for anything one could teach them. They wanted to keep up the standard, and they often used to come to me and say, I'm having a dinner party on Friday, and what do you suggest? And instead of giving them suggestions, one's opening remark always was, what have you got? And you'd sort of start from that. Well, I've got a tin of corned beef, and I haven't had my meat ration for 2 weeks because I've been saving it up. You could do that. And I've got this and that. So with those basic things, you planned a menu. But going back to this enchanting lady, who was one of the people I remember so well, she came very regularly. And I could see over the months that she was beginning to get quite keen on cooking. And she used to report her successes to me. I didn't hear about the failures, perhaps she didn't have any. And it was years later, after I'd left Harrods, which was in the early 50s, that I was scuttling through the food hall, because I always loved going back to Harrods. And suddenly there was my lady. I don't think I ever knew her name, but she looked just as exquisitely dressed. She looked wonderful all the war years. She'd obviously got a wonderful wardrobe. My dear, she said, I'm so glad to see you again. I can't tell you how grateful I am for all you taught me. I said, I was glad. And she said, I've got a cook now. And I said, oh, what good. She said, but you know, my dear, I never let the cook take liberties like they did before. She said, I keep the golden syrup and the honey in my wardrobe. And when cook wants it, she has to come and ask. And I had a lovely picture of cook coming in saying, 2 tablespoons of golden syrup, madam. And I couldn't remember what demonstration I gave where I told people to cook, keep syrup and honey in the wardrobe. I must have suffered from amnesia, I think. And that is the sort of person that I dealt with, but all sorts of other people as well. Another instance that I think shows how we were all together. I was shopping in Harrods one day. It's funny, we sort of built up in Harrods a sort of Morse code with our faces. And the assistant serving me suddenly stopped and sort of went, indicated there was someone behind me that I should step aside. And so by that time, knowing all the signs in Harrods, I duly stepped on one side. And there was the Princess Royal, King George's daughter, Princess Mary. And she was shopping. And she was extremely worried about her eldest son, who was a prisoner of war. And what could she send him? Now, we all joined in that conversation. We didn't drop curtsies. There wasn't time for curtsies in those days, and I'm sure she wouldn't have expected it. I know I went scuttling off in one direction to try and find from the bakery what she should send. And the assistant stopped what she was doing and she said, but there was no sense of, in her part, you know, aren't I being expended to talk to these people? There was no sense in our part. We were talking to a worried mother who had a son who was a prisoner of war, and we were asked to help. And we were helping to the very best of our ability. And that is the whole attitude that was around then. I was extremely lucky, I think very much luckier than many of my colleagues during those years, because I met people from all around the world, really, because Harrods, or London, was a place for refugees. King Philip of Yugoslavia, tragic Yugoslavia, and his young wife came. They promised to send me recipes, but I never got them. But I did get recipes from all parts of the world, nearly. People came to my demonstrations, said, I wonder if you'd be interested in a Czechoslovakian recipe. I'd love it. I couldn't make it then because I couldn't get the things, but I made a note of it and it went down in all my wonderful collection. So I was very fortunate from that point of view that I gathered together recipes from around the world. So I had a wonderful time when rationing finally ended. Other things that happened to me during those years, I was invited to broadcast on the kitchen front. Now, I must explain what the kitchen front broadcast was. This was a 5-minute broadcast from 8:10 to 8:15 every morning. And it wasn't just people like me who broadcast. It was anyone who had a message that was relevant to food and health. So I would give a recipe. And again, I would not say, oh, I'm sorry, the fat is short. I would say, now here it is, and straight into it. But it wasn't just me. People like Mabel Constant-Duras would broadcast. Now, she was a wonderful character. She was a variety artist and was best known for her family of Cockneys. And grandma of the Buggins family they were. Grandma Buggins was a pain. She typified the grumblers, and of course there were grumblers. We all had a grumble sometimes, but Grandma Buggins was the end. Oh, I don't want my cup of tea without the sugar. And that was the message, and immediately Mum or one of the children, oh, Gran, don't grumble like that. Mum's got a lovely recipe for a cake that hardly needs much sugar, and therefore you'll have more sugar for your tea. And that was a clever way. You see, if people didn't want to listen to my sort of broadcast, which was fairly factual, Grandma Buggins and the Buggins family would give her a recipe, cheer her up, and help in just the same way. We also had a wonderful, wonderful broadcaster, the radio doctor. Dr. Charles Hill, he became Lord Hill, and I believe I'm right in saying a governor of the BBC. He was like Winston Churchill in that it wasn't so much what he said sometimes, but how he said it. And he used to tell you to eat your greens, and he had a sort of growly voice. And he used to sometimes say, watch those bowels. Now, why should one want somebody to say that to you at 8:10 in the morning, and you laugh? It was simply because it was so normal, and it was normality that we really wanted. But he had lots of stirring messages. Oh, he was a joy. He really was, you know, if you were feeling, he used to pick you up just like Churchill did. And while Churchill's speeches are so famous, and we all used to listen and feel better, the thing I remember so much, again, on a dark day, was when he described Hitler as Mr. Schickelgruber. Now, I mean, how could you take seriously and be frightened of a man called Schickelgruber? I mean, immediately you felt, oh, soon deal with that Schickelgruber. And those were the little things we hung on to. Those were the little things that made life really, I can only use the word normal or fun again.
Could I ask you about your recipes? You know, you obviously invented quite a lot, is that right?
Yes, the Ministry of Food used to publish recipes. They had food facts in the papers and lots of very good leaflets, excellent leaflets, which you could collect or were distributed to them. I used to have them at Harrods, and would you like a leaflet about oatmeal? Because oatmeal was one of the foods that we were urged to eat. Plentiful, cheap, a source of protein, nutritious, and readily available, like flour. Like bread, until bread rationing came. These were the boosters. These were the things that eke out the rations. But I did discover I gave 11 demonstrations a week, morning, afternoon, Monday to Friday, and one Saturday morning. Now, although the audience changed, there was often a nucleus of regulars. So I couldn't do the same things over and over again. So when I'd exhausted the official sort of recipes, again, how lucky. I had to say to myself, Marguerite, this is no good. You've jolly well got to start and invent them. And this is when I got into the habit of creating recipes. You see, I think to start with, you've got to have an ability. You've got to have a background knowledge to know what goes with what. But you've also got to encourage that. And it's like anything that interests you, if you really stick at it, it doesn't necessarily get easier, but your mind thinks more quickly. Today, of course, it's not difficult to invent recipes because we have such a variety of foods. But there we were inventing recipes within a very small circle of food. There are all sorts of other things that we did get. Pasta, we weren't pasta eaters in those days, and pasta wasn't particularly plentiful, but somebody unleashed upon us a terrible thing called soia getti, made with soia flour, and it took every bit of inventiveness to make that even partially edible. Odd fish came around. One of them, I'm always rather sorry that we weren't better at it, was salt cod. Now, people who travel to Europe these days will have had salt cod in Portugal, Spain, because it's a delicacy there. But you see, the British were used to fish being fresh. I must add that if you didn't live by the seashore, very little fresh fish was fresh. It was a difficult thing to say. It was really rather tired fish, so I had to invent in Harrods. Theirs perhaps were better than some, but no, it had had to travel, and it was the travelling that was the difficult thing. Ways almost to disguise the fish in some ways, but some people in the country, I don't think, hardly saw fish at all. So that is how I came to develop recipes and create recipes.
Can you remember any particular triumph of yours, you know, with a sort of minimum of vital ingredients, which...
Yes, some of my eggless cakes were, and I still use those today because certain people are allergic to eggs. And of course, when the scare came some years ago about salmonella in eggs, everybody thought lovingly of dried egg, which came back on the market for a brief time, and eggless cakes. But it's mostly people who are allergic to eggs. Those were a triumph. And while I think the very first fruit one wasn't my recipe. It was given to me by somebody at a demonstration. Would you like it? And of course I always said yes, please. And it had been given to her by somebody, mother or grandmother during the First World War, who'd been given it by somebody in Canada, I think. And it uses tea. Now that is a very famous cake. You may say it's one of my triumphs for demonstrating it, but I didn't innovate that. But it's the most interesting cake that you put the dried fruit into a saucepan with the tea, and you boil it all up together, and then you let it get cold, and you add it to flour and a very little fat and a very little sugar. And it makes a delicious cake, no eggs. And I've experimented with that recipe using milk instead of tea, using fruit juice instead of tea. Doesn't work half as well. The tea is the magic ingredient in that. So that was a triumph. I did a lot of experimenting with whale meat. And if I talk about it long enough, I should begin to smell it, because it was the most obnoxious smell on earth. When I tell people that today, they look horrified, because of course we regard whales as such special creatures. I must say that it was one of the least pleasant of my experiences. What was whale meat like? A little like oily, fishy beef. The same texture, a little bit like liver. But funnily enough, if you don't prepare it, it's quite pleasant. My sister married a Norwegian, and she always was trying to find things in the early 50s that I might not have tried, or probably middle 50s, because Norway took a long time to recover. In the early 50s, they were still terribly short of food. And I went there, I remember once, and she said, "I've got something delicious for you," and a lovely appetizing casserole came up. I took the first mouthful, and I thought, reindeer? No, what else could it be? And then I thought, oh, I know this. But I didn't dislike it then, because I hadn't had the preparation of it. And that was the horrid part of it. And then we had a fish kindly sent us, a canned fish from South Africa, snook, S-N-O-E-K. The British didn't like that either. Ungrateful lot, weren't we? It's a bit like tuna, but we weren't really into tuna. You see, I think we might quite like it today because we've become accustomed to canned tuna. But canned tuna was unknown to us during those years. And therefore, we weren't going to have a first cousin snook. So like salt cod, we never really used it as much as we should. And try as I might, you ask for great successes. I think my ideas with salt cod were probably great failures because the public didn't want it. The fishmongers soaked it. To try and lure people to have it. We have soaked this fish for you. It's all ready to take home and cook. No, it has got a special quality. I think probably the trouble with that is if you taste it in Mediterranean countries, they have peppers and garlic and lots of onion. Now, we never saw peppers during those years. And we were garlic, most of us, oh no, I must accept myself, I did like garlic, but most people thought garlic was horrid foreign stuff. So that we didn't give it a fair chance. I think the Christmas recipes I created from what was available became very popular. You couldn't make marzipan because we couldn't get ground almonds. And there was an awful alternative with soya flour. And I'm sure it was very good for you because soya is a wonderful source of protein. But I, for one, would rather have my Christmas cake in those days without marzipan, thank you. There was another one with breadcrumbs, another one with semolina. So all those kind of things we did because we were determined to celebrate Christmas. My mother used to sort of haunt the butcher and hope for a chicken. I think she managed to get one most Christmases, but of course country people could have their chickens.
Do you think it really turned out to be a very fair system, rationing? Or were there, you know, could you buy things, sort of, for instance, the black market?
I'm asked this question a lot today. And obviously, I can only reply as far as I know the subject. I think we all felt during those years it was relatively fair. I say relatively because town people would say, oh, in the country they can catch rabbits and they've got chicken and they have a pig. They couldn't keep all the pig. There were rules about that. You could keep a certain amount. And country people, on the other hand, that's why I'm glad I was in Lincoln first, because I knew a bit about country people, and then I came back to town, would say, aren't they lucky in the town? They have British restaurants. The butcher might have sausages or liver, which were unrationed. There are more oddments. I don't know quite what they meant by oddments, but they thought little bits you might pick up in the shops, which were quite legal. So I can only say, from my point of view, that I think we all felt that rationing was very fair, with those sort of slight exceptions, but it was they balanced each other out. It's only the last few years that I've been slightly shocked when modern people, and I don't know where they get their facts from, have said to me there was a terrible amount of black market. Now, maybe there was, but I did not know about it, which makes me sound either guileless or stupid or something. But I suppose I wasn't in the circle that moved like that. I mean, if you, in the days when I was in Lincoln, I went to a mess party. Your eyes were on stalks likely to see what they had that we, the civilians, didn't. But I think we would argue, by Jove, they deserve it. They should have it.